John Baker Carr, Reel 2. You were telling me about the tests that you had to take to be given a commission.
Yes, well, when I first filled in the necessary form as applying for a short-terms commission, the first response to that was a medical examination in London to see that one's physique was acceptable and good eyesight. That was all that happened in London. Then, in the next spring, about April 29, I was sent to Uxbridge for, I think, something like 2 or 3 weeks, purely for to learn how to salute, drill, do some PT to make sure one was reasonably physically strong, and then, of course, have one's uniform tailored and made preparatory to moving to the Air Force proper, which was one's flying training school.
Did your bout of malaria have any influence?
No, it didn't. No, and thank goodness that that seemed to have left no disabilities at all, and I don't think, although I spoke of it in my medical examination, there was no sign of any adverse effect from it.
So in April 1929, you went to the 5th Flying Training School at Sealand.
That's right.
How was the initial training in flying conducted at that time?
Well, each pupil was apportioned to one of the flying instructors. He probably had a total, each flying instructor probably had a total of 2 or most 3, I think. I had a really bad one. And since he's long since passed out of this world, I can say that he really was bad, and other instructors afterwards told me they agreed. And I found that while other fellow trainees were getting on with their flying very well, I was making very little progress. And this I attributed to the fact that my flying instructor was so nervous of giving instruction that he never let me take the joystick and rudder and the throttle of the aeroplane myself. Consequently, after 4 or 5 hours flying, when my fellow pupils were getting pretty confident of elementary flying, I really felt that I was getting nowhere at all. And when I'd done something like 10 hours, it was discovered by the chief flying instructor that I was making no progress. I don't think he knew why, and there was really some chance of my being chucked off as being chucked out as being unable to learn to fly. So the chief flying instructor then turned me over to off this instructor to a very well known man in the Air Force, another enormous character, Lord Bandon, the Earl of Bandon, who was one of the flying instructors there, and he was a great extrovert, and he simply made me fly the thing, aeroplanes entirely. He had no fear of the aircraft getting out of control due to pilot error, and I learned very quickly with him and became perhaps better almost in aerobatics than most of my fellow students. So much so that after I'd done half my course and finished on elementary training on Avro 504Ks, I was given an above average rating and put on to training for fighter aircraft. The people with the best sense of touch and fastest reactions were put on to fighters as compared with the rather slower, reliable people who went on to Army Co-op aircraft and bombers.
You were a mixed group, were you, of short service and permanent commission people?
No, the flying training school was entirely for short service commission officers, except with one exception, and that was anybody who came from a university. Obviously, they came at the age of 22. having done their university training, and if they were fortunate enough to have had a university air squadron, then they'd also had some elementary flying training as well. But they came there, and they were given permanent commissions before they actually came to the flying training school. And we had one of those.
What planes did you do your instruction for fighters on?
We did them on the wretched Siskin. I say the wretched Siskin because it was a very difficult aeroplane to land. It was heavy on the controls. It had a very big angle of landing to get the tail wheel down, and if you didn't get the tail wheel down and land on three points all at once, you tended to bounce on the two front wheels higher and higher until the thing pitched over onto its nose. And this happened quite a few times, and later in when I was in squadron service, it was a difficult and badly designed aircraft, in my opinion. I had no reason to change my opinion.
You told me last time that amongst pilots there was something known as the Siskin's nose.
That's right. There was when people walked around with rather a flattened nose, which I suppose today plastic surgery would have put right for them, you could recognise it immediately as a Siskin nose. It occurred because when you, after your third or fourth bound into the air on a bad landing and the aircraft eventually toppled into the ground, you fell forward, despite your harness straps. You fell forward and banged your nose against a rather ill-padded scuttle above the instrument panel. And this almost inevitably caused, it, at best, a bleeding nose, at worst, a Siskin nose, which you had to have dealt with.
Did you have any near misses while you were actually at Sealand under training?
No, fortunately I didn't. But I got so self-confident when I was on Siskins, I think very much due to the encouragement of Paddy Bandon originally, who was a marvellous aerobatic pilot, that I became overconfident, and my instructor in advanced aircraft, that was the Siskins, who was a sergeant pilot, said to me, "You won't last 500 hours." But I did.
Besides flying itself, did they teach you anything else at Sealand?
Oh, very much. Very much so. Air Force organisation, administration, law, navigation, meteorology, probably some few other things I can't think of. Oh, engineering too. That is, elementary aircraft engineering, engines and airframes. Oh, yes, they did.
Could you actually, by the end of that, have repaired a simple fault in an aircraft?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. No, we had absolutely no training there in the use of tools or repair work. It was just to understand the vehicle that you were flying in, so that perhaps if something went wrong in the air, you might possibly be able to correct it due to your knowledge of how the engine worked, or how the ailerons or elevators were controlled, or something like that.
This was all rather classroom training.
Very much so.
It was conducted with lectures.
Yes, it was, very largely.
How did they actually assess your capabilities to put you in the above average class? How did they test you?
Well, at the end of the flying course, you were tested by the chief flying instructor, who was a squadron leader. In those days, a squadron leader was considered a very important man. He was the chief flying instructor, and he went up with each pupil and made a personal test of his ability, putting you through various evolutions of takeoff, landings, aerobatics, judging of distance in landing against a point and that sort of thing on the ground. It was quite thorough.
What kind of aerobatics could you achieve with that kind of plane?
Oh, well, you could do anything with, you could do any aerobatics with the Siskin. There's no question about that, or for that matter, the Abra. You could do any aerobatics with it, but it was a heavy aeroplane with a slow response. The rate of roll on it was slow. It tended, it was very difficult to keep it up when you were upside down in a roll. It tended to sink a bit. You had to get the nose fairly high up. But the worst thing really was its low rate of response to movements of the joystick, control stick.
Did you deal in the weapons of a fighter at all at Sealand?
No, not at all. Not at all. We were there purely to learn to handle the vehicle safely.
So in May 1930, you were posted to 32 Squadron at Kenly. Can you describe what the station at Kenly consisted of at that time?
Yes. By present-day standards, of course, it was a very small airfield perched up on a hill above Whiteleaf Valley, about 4 miles east of Croydon, if I remember rightly. It just had two squadrons on it, each with their own hangar, and a very nice officers' mess building. The two squadrons were the 32 fighter squadron that I went to, which had Siskin aircraft, and there was number 23 squadron, which still had Gamecocks, the last of the wooden fighters. Now, this is something that rankled with us very much in 32 squadron, with these Siskins, which had replaced the Gamecocks, because the Gamecocks were very nice to handle. They were very responsive light aeroplanes, and you could do very fine aerobatics with them with very little effort, whereas the Siskin, by contrast, was a very sluggish affair, although I dare say it had a better rate of climb, and as a fighting machine it probably must have had some advantages. Otherwise the Air Ministry wouldn't have re-equipped the squadron with the Siskin and give it up the Gamecocks, because the Gamecocks were given up something just every year before I got there, much to my chagrin. But 23 squadron still got their Gamecocks, and they really were much to be envied. We all of us did, and they in fact produced one of the best aerobatic teams of three that the Air Force has probably ever had.
What were the actual numbers of men and planes in your own squadron, in 32 squadron at that time?
Well, I think as far as I can remember, we had about 12 aircraft, of which 8 were in use all the time, and this I think was fairly common in fighter command, and each pilot normally had his own aircraft, so that it was very, very different to today. Your aircraft you felt was rather your own property, and although there was obviously a training program all the time, that you had to do so many takeoffs, landings, camera gun, map reading, battle climbs, so as high as the aeroplane would go through any sort of weather, you were very much on your own. Once you got into the aeroplane, you were very much on your own, quite different to, say, the latter stages of this last war, where as soon as you got into an aeroplane, and I did it, flew jets up to the age of 51, as soon as you got into the aircraft and closed the canopy, and of course I must hark back to the fact in our early days at Kenya, they were all open aeroplanes, but as soon as you closed the canopy on, say, a Meteor or any jet, or a piston engine even before that, you had to turn on the RT and get in touch with the tower and call for permission, actually, to move at all, to taxi away towards the runway.
Were you allowed to personalise your aircraft at all in the way of markings on them or altering the equipment inside?
The answer is no, you weren't. I don't know that anybody really, there was no fashion for it, I don't think. Certainly not not at Kenley. There was later in the war, obviously, but no, there wasn't any fashion for it, nor was there any reason why you would want to alter the aircraft. And of course, it was quite against the rules to alter it in any structural way. Although I'd, in fact, modified the ring sight on mine for a practice camp, merely by filling in the ring with some fine gauze and making a hole within that, which gave me a much finer centre to my sight, and I did very well with it.
What were your relations like in general with the other squadron, 23 squadron, on the base? Were you great rivals?
Well, we weren't rivals because we were beaten before we started. The Siskin was, as I've said, was a heavy airplane. You couldn't put up the sort of show you could that you could with the Gamecock with a Siskin. And so from that point of view, we just had to accept facts. But we're all great friends. There's no question about that. I mean, probably my best friends were in the other squadron. And Cranwell at that. Cranwell-wise.
Was there any kind of class distinction in the way they behaved or the way they were regarded between the Cranwell people and the short service people?
No, I think you can say there was no class distinction at all. But what you could say is that the Cranwell chaps regarded themselves, I think probably quite rightly, as a cut above all the rest being the short service officers and the sergeant pilots, because they'd had, first of all, they had to pass, I think, the civil service exam before they were accepted for Cranwell, and then they did a couple of years at Cranwell and had very good education and flying training there, and they were people whose eyes were set on a career in the Air Force, and they, in fact, were the hard long-term core of the RAF, and so naturally they regarded the rest of us, and I think quite rightly, as rather temporary additions to it.
What was discipline like at Kenley? Were you allowed to be a wild bunch there?
I think discipline, it's very hard to compare it because times are so different, but there was a fair amount of indiscipline, I think probably due to the short service officers and some of the old sweat Royal Flying Corps ones, who really had no long-term interest in the service. And there were, in fact, quite a few courts martial in my time at Kenley, which was only a year and a half, mostly due to bad checks, and one or two due to wild parties, largely stimulated by perhaps too much drink in the mess, where people had their legs broken, and there was at least a court of inquiry always resulted, and very often followed by a court-martial.
Were there any court-martials for flying offences of any kind?
Oh, there were. Oh, there were indeed. Low-flying was regarded with the utmost disfavour, and there were, in fact, two courts-martials for low-flying when I was there, and I was jolly lucky not to get court-martial myself, because we all did it at one time or another. And, well, there were other things. For example, a very nice man went and circled round above the school where his sister was, and he wasn't really watching his airspeed, and he stalled in and crashed by the school, and very lucky to remain alive, and he was very badly broken up. Well, I think that the powers that be reckoned he'd had enough punishment in the crash not to court-martial him or kick him out.
If you were actually found guilty at a court-martial, were you automatically discharged, or were there other punishments?
Well, I suppose there were other punishments, but in my memory, you were cashiered nearly always.
Your own squadron was actually re-equipped with bulldogs while you were at Kenly. Were they a very different cup of tea from the Siskins?
Yes, they were a great improvement on the Siskin. They were a more compact. You see, a Siskin, I don't think it got its name from it, but it was a sesquiplane with a large... It was a biplane with a large upper wing and a rather a small lower one, the two being joined by V-struts, if I remember rightly. Now, the Bulldog didn't have... It need to have this large upper plane. It was rather more towards the Gamecock sort of thing. Smaller wings, but both the same, the upper and lower. Metal, a very good engine, the Bristol Bulldog. And quite a nice response to movement of the control column, which the Siskin had not, and much easier to land. And altogether, a very much nicer aeroplane, but still not as lively and responsive as the wooden Gamecock.
While you were at Kenly, at that time, of course, there was a great scarcity of money available for the services in general, and particularly the RAF. Did that affect your own squadron in terms of spares, equipment, limitations on training in any way?
No, absolutely not at all. Not at all. In fact, it amazes me now, in times of far greater affluence, the degree to which the services are economically conscious in the use of fuel and spares and cost effectiveness of the aircraft and the training of the pilots and all the rest of it. No, I'm afraid we really didn't think in those terms at all, nor was it really brought to our notice that we might be wasting ammunition if we didn't aim very carefully when we were practice camp.
Let's talk now a little bit then about the actual kinds of things that you did as a fighter squadron. Let's talk first of all about what you did while you were actually at Kenly, and then we'll talk about the practice camp. So while you were actually at Kenly itself, what kind of things did were you set to do?
Well, there was a training syllabus that you had to complete in the year, if I remember correctly, and that involved purely flying handling in all sorts of situations, that is, of taking off and landing in a small area, forced landing, simulating as if you had a dead engine. You did map reading, navigation, camera gun, That is, you got up with another aircraft and you had dogfights with each other, and when he came into your sights at the right angle of deflection, you pressed your button. This took a photograph, which was subsequently developed and discussed by your flight commander, or if you had an armoured officer on the station, whether it was a good shot or not. We did formation flying. We did these battle climbs, which I think were limited by the performance of the engine and aeroplane itself to about 10 or 12,000 feet. Of course, we had no oxygen, and up at those heights, it was really very exhilarating, because you're way above the clouds, and the air was very low temperature, very dry, and if you weren't careful, you could become sleepy with the shortage of oxygen, and I think the cold air. But how we did it, climbed up through the clouds without the elaborate instrumentation, which is an absolutely sine qua non in present-day aircraft, I don't know. We had, I think in our Siskins, we had merely this a ball in a curved tube which was supposed to tell you whether you had side slip or not. And that's just about all. And that really was quite useful. You could tell whether you were climbing or diving by the speed of your engine on its propeller, since they were fixed pitch in those days. You could tell whether you were turning or not. Oh, there was a turn indicator, a very crude one. Yes, there was. There was a turn indicator which told you whether you were turning to the right or the left. And this ball in the tube told you whether you've got the right amount of bank on for it. But they were crude. And it amazes me, as I say, that there were very few accidents due to aircraft pilots losing their control of their aircraft in cloud or low visibility.